You're listening to All the Best, and this week we're hearing stories about what it means to be loyal to your job, to your partner, or to yourself. Our first story comes from a man who has been committed to his job for the last 28 years. It's a job people aren't exactly queuing up to do, and yet our society kind of takes the service for granted.
I'm not sure that the public has a realisation of just how much rubbish we make. I can only imagine the rats and the diseases that would be going through average households if it wasn't for the garbos picking up your rubbish. Yep, my name's Ian Hankinson. I'm 48 years old, lived on the Central Coast for all of my life. Worked on the garbage since I was 21. Back then we used to run behind the trucks. Had to be pretty fit, pretty hard going. My favourite thing about being a garbo, look, I enjoy getting up early. I enjoy being in the truck. I enjoy being by myself, listening to the radio. You know, you're out there on your own. No one's watching over your shoulder. I enjoy getting home reasonably early with family and kids. I can usually make school knockoff, pick the kids up, so that works. An average day for me is getting up at 3:30 a.m. Starting at 4:15, doing a truck check, making sure the truck's roadworthy. Leave the yard, work for about 5 hours, have half an hour break. Got some beautiful children on couple of my runs that follow the trucks. They adore them. Do another 5 hours, back in the yard around 2 o'clock, 2:30. I used to prefer the running. It was more fun. Just doing your thing with the boys, just trying to outrun each other and get the job done as fast as you could, because back then as soon as you finish you could go home. In 28 years of being a garbo, I've never been able to take long service leave. Never been able to, because you know, at the end of the contract, you've been there 10 years. A new company comes along, you apply, you get the job, the old contractor pays you out, and you start fresh. I am a union delegate with TW, have been for 8 years. The unions are there to protect people, make sure their rights are upheld. Look, it can be a dangerous job. I've seen people have their hands crushed in the back of reload vehicles through to car accidents, right up to fatalities on the road. With the structure, they put out 10-year contracts. So during those 10 years, you do enterprise bargaining for your pay rises and your conditions. Then you find you get to the end of the contract. Council are looking for something cheaper, as is the way councils operate. So they'll put out a new tender, and it's pretty well open slather. All the companies can undercut each other, undercut your current wages and conditions.
Local waste operators on the Central Coast are worried they could be facing a massive pay cut.
There could be some full rubbish bins around the Central Coast later this week, with our waste collectors agreeing to strike indefinitely.
The garbos decided to go on strike today, and industrial action will continue tomorrow.
So we stood together, we striked, we caused a lot of trouble on the coast. You're affecting the whole community. You're leaving their rubbish on the streets. Council obviously get very upset. Radio stations have people calling in who are very upset. Social media goes through the roof. But we stood strong. We had a week off, straight off the bat, to start the action. But like I say, we'd had enough. I mean, it's just ridiculous that you have to reapply for the same job you were doing yesterday. With a new contract, so we stood firm. I mean, one day there we had 70 blokes at 4 o'clock at every railway station on the Central Coast handing out flyers to highlight our plight. The next day, council were inundated with phone calls, objections, and I mean, that was a great way to get our message across to the community. People power, people on the ground doing the work, handing out the flyers, grassroots, that's where you really have to make your mark, and for us it did pay huge dividends. Made it through to the Minister for Local Government, and we were able to come to an agreement for this contract where it set minimum wages that they could tender at, and also ensured our long service and entitlements would transfer across to the new company. I think most people, they fill their bin, they put it out on bin night, the truck comes very early, it's gone, they wheel their bin back in. They should just realise that the Garbos are hard-working, ordinary folk out there trying their best to keep the streets clean. Should be nice to them. Should give them a beer at Christmas.
That story was by Bridget Harrilau, with news audio by Jane Goldsmith from NBN News, as well as Scott Levi and Emma Simkin from ABC Central Coast. Our next story is from our friends at Spun, a live storytelling night in Darwin. Nick Hose shares what loyalty in love looks like when long work hours and an ocean get in the way. Turn up the volume on this because it comes with some swearing.
I have to say that there's no guidebook for dating a mergers and acquisitions investment banker, but there should be. This is what you need to know. It's nothing like the movie Pretty Woman. And as much as I would like to imagine that I was Julia Roberts, I clearly wasn't. And as much as I would like to imagine that he was Richard Gere, he wasn't. The reality is that investment bankers spend about 90% of their life at work in a building that federal law will prevent you from being able to go to. And because of insider trading laws, they'll never be able to talk about what they do at work. So an enormous part of their life is completely unknown to you. And on that note, we met a couple of hours before I turned 30. We'd been chatting on Grindr, which is an online hookup app, for months. He had a picture of himself reeling in a giant barramundi, and I imagined myself to be that giant barramundi. Every single time we were going to meet, I would cancel at the last minute. It was such a terrible habit. And so finally, we agreed to meet for a drink. Needless to say, we hit it off, and later that evening, as his head lay on my chest, we watched the clock radio next to his bedroom go from 11:50 to 11:59 to 0000. And he looked up at me in the dark of his Melbourne bedroom and said, "Happy birthday." And I said, "Fuck, I'm 30. I was highly disappointed the next day when he didn't send flowers, call me, text. I was even more disappointed to find out he was still in the closet. Especially as I'd already planned our wedding, that's the thing. The names of our first two children, our dogs, what breed they were going to be. Shall I tell you? A sheepdog and a King Charles Cavalier called Teddy. Somehow, we stayed in touch. He was a little young to be made a vice president at JP Morgan Chase in New York, and I felt a little old to be moving to Darwin to present the Macca's Hot Lunch at Hot 100. From his corner office in Midtown Manhattan overlooking Central Park, he would listen to me present the Macca's Hot Lunch. And I would sit in a darkened little studio in Peary Street overlooking the bins behind Uncle Sam's. And he would send in little song requests. All the hits on Darwin's number one hit music station, Hot 100. G'day, Nick with you. Taking you through till three this afternoon. Coming up this hour, your chance to score a free Macca's hot lunch. It was a little depressing every single day having to drum up the enthusiasm to give away free McDonald's and play Taylor Swift songs, but knowing that he was listening from New York did make it easier for me. We endeavoured on something that you may have done yourselves called monogamous long distance, and if anybody's done it, you'll know that it's fucking awful. But, you know, over time we discovered that phone sex wasn't that bad and that Skyping in different countries and different time zones was, you know, like kind of manageable. But when I got a visa to the United States, I was really bloody happy to be leaving Darwin. A friend drove me to the airport in his brand new Holden Calais, and I remember looking out the windows of his car at the palm trees on the Stuart Highway as they danced and wrestled in the breeze, going 70. And because you can do that in Darwin. And my friend looked at me and said, "You'll never come back to Darwin." And I looked at him and I laughed and I said, "I'll never, ever come back to Darwin." When I arrived in LA, tired and jet lagged, I saw this sensible man in a suit, handsome, dark hair, beautiful, sensible shoes, sensible kind of haircut. And I kept staring, thinking, this guy is so good looking. I'm going to have to actually go over and introduce myself. And then finally, the handsome suit looked up at me and smiled and said, "Hi, Nick." Rodrigo had flown from New York to LA to meet me just so we could start our lives in New York together. It was the most romantic thing anyone had ever done for me, ever. If you were to drop a coin through the middle of this library, it would probably come out somewhere in Central Park, maybe not very far away from where we lived, on the corner of East 18th and 3rd. We rented an apartment off Diana Ross, and true story, we get her mail sometimes. I was very tempted to open it. And for the first, you know, year, it was really like something out of her love songs. It was like My Endless Love, or even I'm Stepping Out. According to my Instagram feed, we led the perfect New York life. We'd spend our weekends in upstate New York or exploring the Chelsea markets or having brunch, and we became connoisseurs of the Bloody Mary. Bloody Marys with vodka, Bloody Marys with gin, Bloody Marys with extra Tabasco or bacon. Just don't ever order a virgin Bloody Mary, ladies and gentlemen, because that's a waste of good tomato juice, in my opinion, anyway. Our friends held us up as the perfect odd couple. They believed in us, and sometimes I feel like they believed in us more than I actually believed in us. Those differences between us were never more apparent than when we were at home. I would take these long, luxurious 20-minute showers. I would use every single conditioner and soap, face masks, and I'd get water all over the ground. It would drive him crazy. And he would have these short, stoic, cold, 2-minute showers, like a hangover from boys' boarding school. I loved old vintage furniture, stuff that had funny smells that was pre-loved. He loved brand new black sleek appliances that came in polystyrene boxes. About a year into our time in New York, and those differences between us started to be less funny and maybe a little bit annoying, as can happen. And he got put in this really big business deal, which basically meant he wasn't home very much. And I became a really big fan of American football. No, not because I really like American football, but because it would play on the bars in New York where I would drink alone because I didn't want to be alone at home. Or worse, at home alone with him, but feeling like I was alone. Anyway, I guess in a way we'd sort of become comfortable in our rut. But we decided to soldier on, and we decided that it would be a good idea for me to get a brand new visa so that I could stay longer in the United States. So we enlisted the help of Morty, who was a semi-retired Jewish accountant in Staten Island. And Morty would take a really long time to do anything, and sometimes when we'd ring him, he'd sort of, you know, forgotten who we were. But anyway, it didn't matter. We stuck it out with Morty. We were loyal to Morty. I came back to Australia to go to the embassy in Melbourne and I spent a summer languishing at my mother's house. It was a little bit like opening up Pandora's box. One Sunday afternoon, bored, I downloaded Grindr, the very same app that I'd used to meet Rodrigo 2 years before. And as I went through the endless headless torsos of men, I found him, a chef. And we decided to meet for a drink. And then another drink, and then another drink. And before I knew it, we were saying stupid things to each other like, I love you. I guess he made me feel a little bit alive, but it was a mistake. I flew back to the United States when I got my visa, and I so desperately wanted to tell Rodrigo that I'd had an affair. And there were so many occasions where I almost did. And it was right on the tip of my tongue, but I thought, well, I don't want to ruin this dinner or hurt his feelings, or maybe now's not the right time. I couldn't find the right time. And then finally I made a bargain with myself that I wouldn't tell him. I figured that it would only hurt his feelings, and I didn't want to hurt his feelings. And besides, our lives had sort of gotten better somehow, and I felt like we really were as happy as we looked in our Instagram feed. For real. And then one Sunday it happened. We were sitting at home listening to jazz when he says to me, we need toilet paper? Strange, I thought. I don't know if we needed toilet paper, but anyway. So he was gone for a really long time. And when he came back, his face was this colour of grey that I'd never seen it before. It was totally ashen. And he walked over to where I was sitting, opened up his laptop and said to me, how do you explain this? And I looked, and there on his laptop was a picture of me and my summer lover holding hands. How do you explain this? He said. My gut just absolutely clenched. I felt like I was going to die. I couldn't breathe. It was the worst moment of my life. Like, people often talk about the worst moment. That was the worst moment. How do you explain this? He asked again. Well, of course I couldn't. And in a strange and sad circularity, he flew me back to LA, the exact place where he'd gone to meet me 2 years earlier when we were starting our relationship. And humiliatingly, he'd arranged for my mother to pick me up. I know, right? You silly duffer, she said. But he wanted to make sure that I was okay, and I appreciated that. Rodrigo and I don't say, I love you anymore. Instead, we finish our phone conversations by saying, Bloody Mary. Because somehow, wrapped up in a New York breakfast drink, we're able to convey all the emotions that we can't say to each other in real life. Bloody Mary.
That story was written and performed by Nick Hose, with story producer Patrick Horton. It was originally aired on Spun, a podcast which brings together a bunch of different voices, telling stories in front of a live audience in Darwin, up in the NT. We're pretty loyal to this wonderful podcast, so you'll hear them on All the Best every couple of months. If you want to be loyal too, you can catch more info about them by subscribing to the podcast. You can check out their website, spunstories.net, or you can find them on Facebook and Twitter. In this next piece, we meet a group of women whose loyalty to a traditional art form has changed the way they see women today. Sylvie Van Wall takes us through dance routines, burlesque bodies, and the loyal community around them. Language warning on this next story.
Okay, this is Mischievous, pre-show nerve jitters. I've just finished doing a quick run through with the feathered fans of both routines I'll be performing tonight. My house is a bum sight. There are rhinestones everywhere, sequins everywhere, bobby pins everywhere. I'm just still trying to figure out where I want to, how I'm supposed to pack everything.
So a couple of years ago, I saw some of my friends perform burlesque. I was fascinated.
Oh, See, it all fell apart.
And how did it work the other night?
The idea of getting up on stage and taking my clothes off, how did they do that?
All right, curls. Do your thing.
I'm a bit of an introvert, so I was terrified by the idea. But they look so confident, sassy, fabulous. I just wanted to be up there with them. So I jumped in. I took some group classes, and now I even perform solo.
You need more,
I know what
pins.
I need to do. I need to put more up here.
It got me thinking, how has this vaudeville striptease become so popular again? And what happens when we get on stage?
People will write whole essays on that.
Burlesque is a celebration of your individuality and confidence on the stage.
Burlesque is about diversity just as much as it is about beauty.
It's more or less about women cheering other women for being completely unashamed.
It really helped me discover who I wanted to be, what I could be, and who I wasn't.
Burlesque is freedom of expression of your truest self.
Yes, bitch. Yes.
Burlesque for me is a creative community filled with incredibly talented and welcoming group of people.
You feel like you belong somewhere, maybe where you never thought you belonged anywhere before. So it's wonderful. It truly is wonderful.
There are so many different types of burlesque. There are these traditional shows where performers start with long conservative dresses and hats, and even just slowly pulling off a glove becomes a sensual striptease. Other routines, like the fan dance, are feathered and explosive. Performers are wearing next to nothing, but they cover themselves with large feathered fans and tease the audience with flashes of nudity. Underneath it all, there's this key detail. These glittery stick-on nipple covers, sometimes they have tassels on the end. And we call them pasties.
It's not like, all right, so by the end of 8 weeks, we need to have done an 8-week challenge and everyone go to the gym 5 times and you all need to look like a fitness model and have boobs, you know? It's not like that. It's like, you as you are so fucking fabulous. Like, let's embrace it and flaunt it and enjoy it. And that in itself is a huge learning curve. And there's just women of all shapes and sizes and they're just fierce and fun and in their own bodies and loving themselves when they do burlesque.
And I feel like that's what burlesque is, the confidence to get up there and share and be vulnerable and share yourself on stage. Like, that's empowering as an audience member, as a performer, as a fellow, like, burlesque nerd.
Hi, I'm Mischievous.
I'm Frenchie Holiday.
I'm Holly Deluxe.
I'm Camellia.
We're the Feathered Fancies!
It's the eve of the Australian Burlesque Festival, which tours the country and is the largest of its kind in the world. I'm talking to the Feathered Fancies, a fan dance group. They're in the final festival rehearsals, getting ready to perform on the big stage for the first time.
Of us is so different, but then when, like, even still watching ourselves in the mirror, I was like, yeah, when we do this switch at the center, I'm like, powerful, boom, like, it's just like this powerful unit where we're unified, and all our our diversity kind of makes us a strong, coherent unit, and burlesque allows individuals to do that.
I think because there's a temptation to want to do it facing the front, but the idea is you're facing the back, so they still don't see anything, still don't see anything, and then you give them, hello, there's my breasts on a platter.
And being a part of this community, you end up forming friendships and you're forming relationships outside of that, and being able to be comfortable in the studio, and you have to trust each other in the studio, you have to trust each other on that stage, and then sharing, you know, like pasty tape, and then
very intimate.
Not recycling it.
Not recycling.
Just to clarify,
just helping each other.
Standing around, like, positioning their nipples together.
Is this clapping?
Ladies and gentlemen, would you please make them very, very welcome? It is the Feathered Fancies!
far too fast. Yeah.
But you can see it as well in everyone's so different in their alter ego.
Yeah.
Like you're talking to people as themselves and then they step on stage and they just become this totally different thing and you're like, oh, I had no idea that was lurking in there. This is exciting.
And it's weird because you're like making yourself vulnerable because you're stripping down to your underwear or beyond your underwear, but it's still such a... The audience love it and you love it and it's a way to embrace who you are.
It's just like when you get in the routine of celebrating just what you can do with your body and how it moves and being able to just express yourself through your body, you, that can't help but overflow into like your relationships, like everything.
Yeah.
When I got on stage, I was so nervous, but that disappeared almost immediately. The audience weren't leering spectators, they were there to support me, and I was there to support myself. And now, even when I'm off stage, I can draw on that feeling of owning my body and being part of this community where everyone is fabulous.
That story was by Sylvie Van Wall, with help from supervising producer Beck Fari. All the Best is made at FBI Radio in Sydney, in association with 3RRR and SYN in Melbourne. Our executive producers are Selena Shannon and Beck Fari. Our community coordinator is Chloe Gillespie. Beth Gibson's our SYN production manager. The show fits together nicely because Tegan Nichols compiles it, and I'm your host, Samantha Groth. Our theme music is composed by Shining Bird, and Annie Hamilton designed the artwork. All the Best is heard all over Australia on the Community Radio Network and is made possible by the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can follow us on Facebook and on Twitter, and every single one of our previous episodes is waiting for you at allthebestradio.com. We'd love you to show your loyalty by subscribing to All the Best on your favourite podcast app.